Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. Today we're talking to the makers of Australia's best gin, John and Sarah Lark from Kangaroo Island Spirits. John and Sarah have been at the forefront of a thriving Australian craft spirits industry for the last 10 years and have won awards for their gin all over the world. It all started with a sea change. The couple visited Kangaroo Island while on honeymoon and decided it was the perfect place to set up their own distillery, on a hunch that gin was about to make a comeback. And they weren't wrong. With a little help from John's brother, Bill, known as the godfather of whiskey in Tasmania, KI Spirits is now producing the most sought-after gin. Their cellar door is a tourist destination on the island. I highly recommend it. Business is booming and the gin market is growing. John and Sarah share their story, which has great successes and many challenges, including export tax and the logistics of working on the island. We also get a great little lesson on the history of gin and the distilling process. Enjoy our chat with John and Sarah Lark from KI Spirits.
John and Sarah, welcome to Rooster Radio.
How are you?
Cheers, thanks for having us.
Now, I want to hear from start to finish the process of distilling gin. Okay. I'm a bit of a layman,
yep,
so I actually wouldn't know the first step. So if you can take us through that, that would be amazing.
There's a number of ways. Traditionally, a gin like Gordon's or Plymouth is made in a large copper pot still. They would typically bring in neutral spirit and they bring it in rather than make it, because good gin distillers want you to taste the botanicals and they don't want you to taste the base spirit that they're using to extract those botanicals.
And what are some – you're going to have to really spell this out for me. What are some base spirits?
Okay. The English will tell you that all gin should be made from grain spirit. What most people in the world don't realise is that the Philippines drink more gin than anybody else. The Spanish drink way more gin than the English. And pure ethanol at 96% becomes fairly philosophical about what it's made from. The Spanish use a lot of grape spirit. We're in South Australia. We use a very good grape spirit as a base.
And so you bring in a neutral spirit?
Yep.
And then?
Okay. We put it into a pot. Like I said, there are a number of ways. If you made something like Gordon's or Plymouth, you'd have a very large copper pot still. You'd get your botanicals, which were very dominant with juniper. The EU definition of gin is a white spirit that's predominantly flavoured by juniper. And you would soak them in the alcohol in the pot. You'd stew them. You'd heat the alcohol up. It turns to a vapour, goes up through the neck, hits a condenser and comes out as gin. That's one way. The way that we make our gin is by vapour distillation, which is the same way that Bombay Sapphire, I think, maybe Hendrix, and a lot of craft distillers are now distilling, where we have a separate chamber off the neck of the still, or in the case of our small still, a small basket, where we hang the botanicals, and when the alcohol evaporates, it passes through the botanicals as a steam and extracts the oils that way. And we find for our palate, for our personal taste, for the stills that we have, that's the way to go. So we use vapor distillation and we use everything at once. Now, a lot of, we've noticed there's this massive, they're calling it the second glorious revolution of gin. There's a lot of gin popping up. There is a wave of winemakers who are moving into the field and bringing with them their skills in making wine. And they will often distill every botanical out singularly, one at a time, line them up on a bench and blend them as if they're blending wine. And there's some good gins out there that are made that way now as well.
Wow. That's a fantastic answer. Sarah, for you, now this question is going to be, I'm sure, largely based on opinion, but what is the difference between a good and a bad gin?
Basically, I guess making sure that you have a really good quality spirit to start with has to be the basic between a good and a bad. So with us, it's a very premium grape spirit. We've sourced it from Tarak and the Barossa. They've got a 10-storey high column still that can make the purest ethanol out there. So it's smooth and it's not interfering at all with the flavour. You'll find that some gins are using less quality, they're the ones that you tend to end up with a hangover the next day. You inevitably regret drinking it. So that's got to be the first point of call. Secondly, it's the botanicals that go into it. So a lot of the lower quality gins are lower flavour to it, you'll also find that the flavour doesn't linger. It might be just a short sort of basic flavour, quite flat, nothing left there to last in terms of, you know, enjoyment from it. We find that the percentage is a little indicator of flavour. The percentage that we've chosen for our gins, so between 42-45%, you're going to allow the flavours to come through better. We've found that the lower the percentage, the less of the flavour profiles you're going to get.
And when you say botanicals, I'm picturing like flowers and leaves.
Yep.
Am I on the money?
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Botanicals is a funny word, but it basically means anything plant or originating. So spices, seeds, herbs, leaves, flowers, roots, you name it.
This might be a strange question, but do you know the history behind gin or what's the origin of the drink?
We actually do an experience where people can learn about the history of gin. We've done it in the Botanic Gardens, so walking through the gardens and looking at the different botanicals that grow there and describe how they became incorporated in gin. But basically, the origins stem right back to early distillation back in the 600s with a very, very basic alembic still. What they were distilling was full of the fusel oil still and the methanol as well. So it was quite hideous. Basically, juniper was added to that to help mask it because it's quite a strong oily flavour. It's also got medicinal properties to it as well. So that's been distilled in spirit for quite some time. Do you want to go on?
Yeah, look, I think historically it's about when it was called gin. You know, as Sarah talked about, it's been around a long time, juniper. You know, we often tell people that there was another lesser-known prophet at the time of Christ who had to perform three miracles, one of which was to make juniper berries on a juniper bush. And, of course, they made a movie about him called The Life of Brian. But if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have gin. But the Italians in the 13th century used distillates of juniper to douse themselves in their houses to try and protect themselves from the plague. So there were juniper distillates that were very medicinal. And it wasn't really until the 1600s. It's attributed to a fellow by the name of Franciscus Silvius or Delabeau, who was a doctor who tried to distill three things, juniper, coriander and angelica root, which he thought were three carminatives. So he was trying to create a carminative, but also the juniper was to use as a diuretic. Now, people were certainly drinking it socially before then, but he attributed it the name Genever, which is the Dutch word for juniper. And it's from there that they say that the drink got its name. Now, it was around before that. And then not long after that, in our terms of looking over history, English fought in the Dutch wars. They learned about Dutch courage. There was the Catholic and Protestant wars going on for centuries. And so there were Flemish refugees that headed over to the United Kingdom at the same time as these mercenaries went home. And then there was what they call the First Glorious Revolution, where a group of noblemen weren't happy with James on the throne because he was Catholic, and they ousted him and put William of Orange on the throne, who was Protestant. And the first thing he did was ban European spirits and let homegrown spirits be made on the streets of London, and gin was the drink, gin being a bastardisation of the word Genever. And the base spirit was so foul, as Sarah said, the English added lots of spices, botanicals, to the gin and all sorts of things to mask it. Sulfuric acid to make it taste stronger, turpentine to make it taste more piney, because, you know, it would have been a very nasty drink and typically drunk neat. Sitting in front of us is a bottle of Old Tom, which is from that period, which is a sweetened gin. Again, it's got sugar in it to make it easy to drink neat. They didn't have Schweppes back in those days or Fevertree, the poor buggers. They had to drink it neat on the street. So that's where it came from. And so it developed from there.
Maybe we should have a little taste of old Tom while we're talking about it.
Sounds good.
So maybe just talk us through, I guess you were talking about the process. How long does it actually take?
The good thing about gin is that it generally it's not aged. So within 3 days we can have the gin started, finished, bottled and glasses
Cheers.
Clinking.
Cheers.
Which is why back in the early days, well, for lots of reasons, in Prohibition, gin was made. Bathtub gin was established back then, where the just everything was just put in the spirit in the bathtub. And then that was how the flavour was added there.
Tomorrow's the anniversary to the end of Prohibition, so we should raise a glass to that.
Yeah.
So at what point did, I guess, your experience with gin become something more than just, you know, it's a drink that I know of, to one that became passionate about gin?
Interestingly enough, it was when my husband was having a gin and tonic with my granny. It was a bit of Dutch courage just before our wedding.
Needed to get drunk, did you?
Look, we'll get to that point. We'll get to there. Don't worry, it's coming.
Awkward moment.
Yeah, no. In essence, it should have been me, but I was 3 months pregnant.
There you go.
Exactly. Sarah and I, it's a bit of a Mills and Boone. We met in the desert in an Aboriginal community and we got married, first time Vietnam, second time with a family in Adelaide, and my brother Bill was there. I'd just finished a degree in aquaculture. Sarah was a teacher, but I'd been out bush for 20-odd years. Couldn't afford to buy a tuna farm. So we said to my brother, let's make gin. My brother being the godfather of whiskey in Tasmania, he said, don't be stupid, it's crap, make whiskey. But we'd noticed, or started to notice, that there was very little gin being made in Australia. And if it was, back then we're talking about 10 or 12 craft distillers in total, mostly brown spirit focused. If they were making gin, it was to pay their bills and to get a bit of cash flow. There was no love or passion. And so we said that we'd like to set up Australia's first dedicated gin distillery to do things properly, the traditional way. And we felt the early rumblings about what was coming out of the UK. We could see things were starting to happen over there.
So you were thinking about this from a business perspective from day dot. It wasn't like a little hobby, you started tinkering with it?
No.
Okay.
Mm. And what year were we talking?
2002. We got married, yeah.
And what did you notice coming out of the UK? What were some of the things that you paid attention to that sort of alerted you to this trend?
One of them was Sipsmith. So Sipsmith started in a small shed in the suburb of Hammersmith in London. We were actually lucky to be able to go and visit them in their early stages, and they were making a premium gin out of just a small still just in the suburbs. And so we thought, well, if they can do it, then we surely could. We got an even smaller still to give us a bit more of an obstacle to overcome, but it's lasted us for 10 years.
Did you have core values as to what you wanted the personality of your products to be like and even your business?
Without a doubt. One of the things that appeals to us about gin, and I often tell people and I sell the door that my brother might be the godfather of whiskey, but whiskey is really just beer distilled. There's actually no art to it. When you're making gin, there's a lot you
hope
can do.
Hope he listens to this.
So do I. Yeah. There's a lot you can do with botanicals. And one of the appealing things about gin is that, you know, we are fairly, you would almost be called old-fashioned because we think gin should still be predominantly juniper-flavoured. It's a choice of ours. Some of the new ones aren't. But then after that, you can do anything you like. Someone once described it to me as us being like sauciers, like French sauciers who were balancing flavours going into a pot so that when it came out, they presented in the right way and were well-balanced. That's a fair point. I guess the other important value is that we intentionally didn't want to get big. A lot of people have come behind us and have got quicker a lot faster. Maybe their model is about a different sort of model, but for us it was about lifestyle, about passion, about looking around us and seeing what's there in terms of the botanicals and being, you know, we haven't got enough time here to try and define what craft is, but you know, we've looked at the beer industry and it's coming again in the spirit industry. A lot of the big guys are now trying to put craft products out because that's where the market is. But really, I don't, you know, craft is about people who are passionate first and have a business model afterwards, if you like.
Well, we did have Glenn Cooper on here still claiming to be the ultimate craft beer. But you can't on Rooster Radio, we're not going to let you get away with just sort of glossing over the beginning of your business. I mean, we're fascinated with the catalyst to take something from an idea to that first point at which it becomes serious. I mean, you just casually said we bought a still. Where did that happen? How much did, you know, the outlay cost for you back then to buy the infrastructure to begin? And give us the story.
We actually selected Kangaroo Island to do this for a couple of reasons. It's it's hard to get to.
No, that's not a good reason.
No, it's a beautiful location. I think that it's honestly a lot of South Australians don't appreciate. I know it costs a little bit more to get there, but when you get there, it just feels as if you have just turned everything off and you can slow down and you can relax.
Unless you run a distillery.
Unless, yeah, you need to get up at six and turn a still on every morning. As John said, we'd lived in the desert, so a sea change was definitely something that we put high on our priority list. And it's still easy to get to Adelaide, relatively.
And it was an early emerging food and wine industry with a tourism base on the island and nobody else doing it. No one was doing it in South Australia, let alone Kangaroo Island. So, yeah.
We really liked the passion of the producers that were already on the island. They weren't big people trying to, you know, just market something that, you know, isn't real. Everything there is genuine and everyone is passionate about what they do down there. So it was a really lovely place to get involved in.
I'm interested in how you actually get started with something tangible. We always talk about ideas, and particularly when we talk about craft brewing wines, everyone has this idea, oh, geez, I'd love to have my own brewery. I'd love to distill my own stuff. What were some of those critical key steps that you took to actually turn it from an idea into a reality?
Good question. Just for the audience, there's lots of like looking at each other. And it's, I love it.
I'm not quite sure.
I think John's stubbornness is one aspect of it all.
Is there a better word than stubbornness?
Passion. Passion, but it's also the stubbornness because there are so many hoops that you have to jump through to get all the licenses that we needed, all the...
Here's my comment I want to make right here. I always like to mention that in Australia, we have the highest excise in the OECD. We are highly regulated. A bottle of that gin sitting in front of us, the tax on that's about $27. Same bottle in America would have $3 excise on it.
$27. And what does that retail at?
We'll come to that, but it retails at $120 a bottle.
Okay. So it's a significant, I mean, my fractions, a sixth or something of the price.
Basically, the government get more from a bottle than what we do. Wow.
No relief like the winemakers. So sorry, that was just a little stab at
Well, so
there.
Far you've canned whiskey and now you've bagged wine. So, where do you go to find the infrastructure? I mean, you mentioned you bought a still from, where was it?
Tassie, still came from. Yep.
Back then,
stills.
It wasn't buying things online. So how do you find it?
We were fortunate to have my brother behind us, ahead of us, not behind us, in terms of him setting up his business. So he bought originally a little copper still without a pot that was probably a military still for distilling water. He bought it at an auction, then he took it to a sheet metal worker in Hobart, company called Minties, and said, can you make a still like this with a big pot? And they did. And so in those days, because it was the craft distilling industry was fairly new and it was a little bit complicated, the easiest way to get in was to replicate what he did. So we simply went to Minties and said, we'll have one of those too. And that meant that they could supply the plans and all the specifications. We didn't have to have it drawn up because they already had it. And we were able to apply for a license that way. So you needed in those days a license to own a still, a license to have one made, and a license to move it, and then a license to sell.
Why?
Well, apparently, it's to do with the excise, I guess. Apparently, the high excise is to stop us all drinking so much. So I don't know. It's interesting.
It seems crazy, doesn't it? So you've got an industry with lots of barriers to entry.
Mm-hmm.
You you're looking at a bit of a sea change as a bit of a catalyst. You've identified a hole in the market. You're seeing what's coming out of the UK. Did you have a brand or a theme in mind as to?
Ooh, yes, we did.
Yeah.
Luckily, we didn't go with the name Island Spirits.
That was our first choice.
Yes.
I like the idea of is gin.
Yeah.
Yeah, more recently, IS has had a different
significance. Yes.
We won't go there.
No. And then somebody recommended to us that really we had to go Kangaroo Island Spirits because from a marketing perspective, you can do so much with Kiss. You know, you can remember your first kiss or, you know, all that sort of, you can play with it.
And I have to say there's something about the Kangaroo Island marketing campaign of windswept coasts and a cooler. I just thought it was a brilliant marketing campaign. And it lends itself to spirits, doesn't it? It lends itself to a nice drink as opposed to being on a beach somewhere. So it seems to match beautifully.
To move slightly away from gin and more to, I guess, how you guys handled the jump personally, so sea change at what, 40, I think?
You bet, right. Yep.
What was that process like, you know, making that jump, stepping out? I mean, you do hear a lot of people who have this fear of changing career at that age. How did you guys deal with that?
Well, I guess John's had various careers through his lifetime, so it's been a bit...
I don't know what I want to be when I grow up.
Whereas I come from teaching and it's... well, I thought it would be quite nice, actually, not to have to do marking and programming through to the middle of the night. But, I'm still trying to work out now. Well, I'm still working around the clock, choosing which 12 hours a day I work, and I don't get school holidays anymore. So, however, the marking now is tasting all the gins that come out and other products and making sure that they still conform to all of our expectations. So I can't complain about that side of the business.
Look, and where we met was a community in Western Australia, which is arguably the most remote community in Australia, 700 kilometres from the nearest town, 12 hours drive. And I've been out there since the late 80s, on and off. So Kangaroo Island gave the feeling of being remote, but we're really only 4 hours away from Adelaide or 20 minutes on a plane like I did this morning. So we can, it's kind of, we grew up a little bit in terms of it's great to be out. We love being remote, but we get to hang out at Central Markets a fair bit as well. And so we've got the best of both worlds. We pick the guts out of Adelaide and then go home to Kangaroo Island. It's good.
So maybe tell us about your first batch.
Gosh.
The lessons learned, some of the challenges. Do you think, geez, we really don't know what we're doing? Or you thought, you know what, actually we're pretty good at this.
Well, there's no one to tell you.
No. It took no school. Some it time to get the recipe right. It was just a matter of we were very lucky because a lot of people volunteered to help in the research department.
I bet.
So that was quite fortunate for us. So
we also, in very, very early on, we won a grant from the Food and Beverage Fund, and we went to Europe and we spent several weeks in a Swedish distillery and we visited Sipsmiths and Plymouth and had a look around the UK and had a bit of a sniff around still factory in Germany and played with some liqueurs in Italy. So that was pretty inspiring.
What were a couple of the things that stood out on that tour?
The notion of peasant-made drinks in Italy. So liqueurs, I just love, I mean, their whole food tradition, their whole slow food tradition and Nonna's recipes and every Nonna's got a different recipe. And I just love that, I don't know if peasant's the word, but I love that village kind of process of making things the real way with a handed-down process, you know, in small batches and using what's around you. We learnt that the Swedish have a very different sense of humour to us, but they were making some interesting spirits. And we were welcomed by some in the UK and shut out by others because there's always that thing in most industries that people are scared you're going to steal what they do. But Plymouth welcomed us, Sipsmiths welcomed us. There wasn't much else in those days in the way of small distilleries. Now there's dozens of them. But so that inspired us. And we played a bit at the Lark Distillery with Bill and Lynn, yeah.
Sarah, you mentioned that you know, you're still working as hard, just in a different way. You've got the financial outlay to get going. Was there a point at which it got really hard where you started to think, oh no, what have we done, before it started to give you the affirmation that you're onto something?
I think
we're still there.
Still there, yeah, absolutely. It's one of those businesses, I guess, most people in a small business, you're always putting whatever you get back into the business to grow the business, to keep up with it. So, it's all, you know, we've got a long way to go still until we can actually see that blue sky. However, we've got a business partner now who is a really fantastic person, knows a lot in the business world, who is really put us on, you know, we're great at distilling and talking about our products, but he's got a head for business, and he's really putting us on the right track as to how to make sure that we're, we'll achieve that blue sky.
And last count, we've got about 15 part-time staff, so we're really getting on. And one of the things that's been pointed out to us, small business is hard. It's refreshing to hear people like the chair of SATC say that it's the small businesses in regional Australia that give personality and character, because that's so true. But they're often the most likely to fail. So we haven't had much help from the banks. Banks weren't interested in us, and we weren't successful in getting any grants. But what it means is that we've learnt to grow our business skills, to run a business in lean times, and come through the other side. We're coming through the other side now, so we're really well set up to survive, if you like. Mm.
And, I mean, for those people out there that are thinking of jumping into their passion and make it full-time, can you also just explain that feeling? I mean, it probably happens for people who become full-time musicians or full-time sports people, where your passion becomes your work. Mm. How do you explain the difference between when you first set out to where you are now in terms of your passion?
No, the passion's still there, but there's all the little bits that you don't like that you can't ignore anymore when you go into it full time. So you just have to, the passion for what we make and the response that we get from people is really rewarding. But you need to be a lot more, I mean, it's like a sports person. You just have to make sure that you do all the hard yards behind the scenes as well, and make sure that everything is still ticking along in terms of the paperwork.
So speaking of getting the feedback from the people around you, you started to get traction. Can you tell us at what point it was when you started to think, you know what, I think we're onto something here. This is actually turning into something really interesting, and we're starting to get a bit of traction.
Look, I think we thought that was there from the beginning, and that it's only ever grown since we started. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had a very long relationship with the Howling Owl bar in Adelaide, which was the first gin bar. Mick Craig, who is the owner of Rhino Room and the Howling Owl, walked into our cellar door and thought he'd come back to Adelaide and make a gin bar. And it's a really nice sort of synergy that we have a relationship with them still. And so we started to see things like, I can remember talking to other bars that were, you know, it's only 4 or 5 years ago, some bars hoping to set up with All Australian Spirits. And now it seems to be regular, which is wonderful. Mm. And then when we have people coming in, we hear looking ahead from where we are in Australia, had a gentleman in from Portland, Oregon the other day who said that we should be there because Portland, Oregon is the centre of craft brewing and distilling in the States. And there are bars there that won't have any corporate products. They'll have hundreds of products, beverages behind the bar, but none of them will be corporate, which is just fantastic. And that's the consumer asking for that. So, and that's the way that we're heading in Australia.
So on that, I mean, you mentioned you've got 15 part-time staff. You won last year Australia's Best Gin.
Yeah.
Give us a few of the other numbers just to contextualise where the company has got to at this point. mean, I know you're on your way to Sydney. You've stopped into the Rooster Radio studio or the dingy office. And
look, we've won awards in London, New York, San Francisco, Hong Kong, and more recently the best gin in Australia for our spirits and liqueurs. We've featured on Landline. We're growing possibly one of the few plantations of true juniper in the country as an experiment to see how they go. And part of we do a lot of gin experiences. We are in the Hall of Fame for small business in South Australia, having won three small business awards over the last 10 years. What else?
How many bottles do you produce in a year?
Roughly. Good question. It's exponential. It's doubling all the time. So
something that
in the tens of thousands.
And are you limited? What are the limiting physical limitations that you have in terms of your distillery? Is it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Where we just commissioned a second still, which is quite a larger still, and it's still in its. It's been running for several months, and it's. Really going to make a difference to our capacity. Where that capacity goes, domestically or internationally, we get a lot of inquiries overseas. But we're also starting to, you know, we started, if you've been to our cellar door, you've seen it's a rustic little shed. Rustic's a good way of saying we had no money to begin with, and we built it up from there with passion, and people love it, tell us we can't get rid of it, but we're going to need a bigger space at some point just because it's so cramped, and every time we make a new space, it fills up. And we're starting to streamline things. Like we now have a machine that will actually apply the label to the bottle instead of having to do it by hand. And, you know, we're still, every time we make an improvement, we still seem to just keep to what the market's asking for. So there's plenty of room for us to grow.
And you mentioned that you still have that customer experience at your cellar door. Have you had some interesting stories, you know, some people that have come from all over the world, you know, to see you guys and have heard about you internationally?
We did actually on the last week. Luke, who works part-time for us as well as a tour company, brought this couple from Canada who were just the most gorgeous couple and who were just so excited about this was the highlight of their trip to Australia, was to go to us because they'd read about us and not sure whether it was just, something online and, to be a celebrity when they, you know, met me, had to shake my hand. It's like, was absolutely fantastic. So, that's really exciting that people are starting to hear about us and actually look to visit the island to see us.
So tell us a bit, we've touched on it, but how the gin market has evolved in the 10 or so years that you guys have been doing things. So I think I read somewhere that we're now up to, is it 300 gins produced locally in Australia or something like that?
There's certainly bars that have got 300 gins in them. I would have thought Australia would be more like 150. I went on to an online store, a spirit store in Melbourne, which I look at periodically, and I pulled 70 Australian gins off there the other day. And that's kind of a reasonable indication, but I'll be not surprised if there's another 70 out there now. Given that 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, we were the only ones in South Australia, there's at least a dozen in South Australia, if not more. We're constantly meeting people who are telling us that we're about to set up a distillery to make gin.
Yeah, and it's obviously in response to a demand for gin. So maybe tell us about, from a consumer perspective, what you guys have learned. My wife's been into gin for basically ever since I've known her as a spirit, but for us, we seem to be the only ones drinking it up until the last few years when now become something really popular. What have you guys noticed about the market?
Really been fascinating through the cellar door. Initially, when we released our gin, a lot of people were coming in going, I drink Bombay Sapphire, which I think they've done an amazing marketing campaign to get people to drink gin. However, then they were, you know, balking at the price of what a premium gin is. So we'd have to spend a lot of time explaining, you know, what the difference is between them and why it costs so much more for us to make it. Whereas now that's rarely a conversation that we need to have. People have educated themselves about gin, and I think that that's been, you know, in Adelaide, it's been a fantastic thing that small bars have done to actually not just offer the usual range, but to bring in more and to be passionate about it and to encourage people to drink different gins.
So who are the drinkers?
That's right. Who are they?
Yeah, coming through the cellar door, who are the types of people that you're seeing?
Well, I have to say, my parents, this is before Monty, you even went there. My parents went to Kangaroo Island mid last year,
yep,
and came back buzzing about going to see you guys and had a great old time. And it was one of two things, and they have been to Kangaroo Island a few times, but it was one of two things they came back raving about. So
right,
clearly there's a range.
There is a strong
absolutely
range.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The demographic is huge. Someone was asking us to narrow it down the other day, but I just can't.
It's, maybe it comes down to volume. Young professionals probably, you know, some of the reports that are out there are indicating that they're drinking a hell of a lot more premium spirits than anybody else. But certainly my generation and older, we recently had a fantastic gin blending session helping the Queen Adelaide Club develop their own gin. So there is a group of women that we work with there who represent all facets of South Australian life. And, you know, it's amazing.
This is, again, another stupid question, but I'll ask it. Can you give me the gamut of how people drink gin, the different ways in which they drink gin?
One of the things that people often will ask me, I'll line five gins up on our cellar door bar and they'll say, which is your favourite? And I'll say, that's like saying to me, what's my favourite wine or beer? Depends what I'm doing today, you know. I probably wouldn't drink our contemporary gins so much, the wild or the own niche like we're doing at the moment. So it really depends on how you want to drink it. And then one of the beautiful things about gin, and thank goodness there's not one gin in the world, there's lots, is there's so many styles. And we have a sweet floral gin, we have a dry savoury gin, we have the aged gin, a whiskey gin, a mulberry gin and an old Tom, which lend themselves to a range of classical cocktails, martinis, gin and tonics, or just sipping like we're doing now, sitting here sipping a lovely gin.
I can honestly say it's a very drinkable spirit, which I didn't expect. I haven't drunk much gin on its own.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, it's a G&T.
Correct. Like yeah.
So this is a great experience. I actually didn't know that you could drink it this easily.
Look, I'll be honest. In 2002, when I had that Dutch Courage on the day of our wedding, I was drinking Gordon's and Schweppes, and that's probably all there was. And that's all I knew about gin, but I've been drinking it for a while. I knew I liked it. But we've learned an awful lot since then in terms of gin, and we're still learning. And when people come into my cellar door and they say, how do you drink this old Tom? Well, I say, I drink it like this, but I'm not offended if you tell me you want to put tonic in it. I think it loses something, but that's up to you. I'm not going to be a snob, but if you want to put Coke in your gin, put Coke in your gin. I'm not going to, you know, it's not my call, but, you know, I really don't want to be a snob and tell people how they should drink gin.
But along with the evolution of gin has also been the tonic. And there's quite a few Australian tonics that are coming out, and tonic syrups as well. So John's son has started selling a syrup that you can add to soda water, which was the original way that tonic used to be served. And then you can choose the dilution that you like and the amount of fizz that you like of the tonic to your taste.
We often go back to the Spanish who drink more than the English, and they have Ginebra bars, and they're the ones who taught us to drink gin in a goblet. The English strangle gin when they put it in a long Collins glass because I understand that there is a chemical reaction, a chemical situation going on when the botanical oils are held in suspension in your gin above 42%. If it's below, they start to come out. So when you add tonic to your gin, the botanicals explode out of it. So you need to have a big goblet to smell it. And in Spain, in the Ginebra bars, you would sit and drink gin and tonic all day, every day, without drinking the same gin twice, without having the same tonic twice. Schweppes have five separate tonics in Spain, which is amazing. And different garnishes. Like we have a spectacular gin garden at our place. And so we'll walk out. People say, how should I garnish my gin? And I walk outside and I'll go outside and see what I can find. And, you know, what's looking good today? Pineapple sage, lemon thyme, lemon bovina. You know, it just depends what's in the garden, what fruits are available. And it's fantastic, you know. Lemon and lime is great in a gin. Cucumber's been around since the 30s. It wasn't Hendrix. Gilby's were doing that in the 30s. But, you know, you can do anything. It's wonderful. It's a diverse drink.
We've touched on it, but James and I were having a chat prior to this interview just about how the drinking landscape in Australia has changed so much. I mean, how do you see it in terms of, you know, our culture was very much beer. It seems like not that long ago, really. And now the emergence of wine, obviously, in South Australia. How do you see it all playing out in the broader spectrum of, I guess, the culture of Australia?
Crumbs, isn't it? Isn't the small bar scene in Adelaide and elsewhere just fantastic? Cheers to the government for bringing that on and the council or whoever was behind that idea. But we've all watched the emergence of the small bar scene in Australia and South Australia, because this is where we are, emerge and create a fantastic variance of social places to go and hang, small places with character and personality. It's just been wonderful. Yeah,
But, I mean, that seems to nail it a bit. Growing up in the early 2000s where you started to drink, it felt to me, and look, maybe it is an age thing, but the purpose of drinking was to get really slammed.
Yeah.
Just get pissed.
Yep.
And it wasn't until I travelled a bit and really saw how Europeans and South Americans, that food and alcohol were linked, and food and drink and family were linked. Mm. It feels to me we are becoming a bit more, I'll say this, you know, I'm not going to walk out on a Hindley Street on a Saturday night, but there is more of an education about where alcohol fits in our landscape.
Yeah.
Tend to be drinking less, but drinking better quality. So we are going out to socialise and still, you know, probably spend the same amount of money, if not more, but on something that we really get a lot more from rather than just the alcoholic high.
We've fast forwarded to this point. How has the evolution of your partnership gone in terms of what roles do you play within your business, and how have you managed the inevitable married?
It was really touchy there last year. Things were on the rocks. You
know? Is this a scoop?
Oh,
is this going to come
absolutely
out in Women's Day or something?
It could. I had to say, when I fell in love with Sarah, one of her major skills was that she could program the video player. And it was sort of early last year, I pointed out to her we didn't have a VCR anymore and things were looking a bit. Yeah, exactly. Then she bloody well went and won Best Gin in Australia. She made this gin that won Best Gin in Australia. So, Sarah.
And so it was the old Tom?
It's the old Tom. Yep.
It's magnificent.
Yep, out of 44 gins, it won the best gin. And I said, well, Sarah, you're a keeper.
You've earned your place.
Yeah. How do you divide up the tasks, though, or is it just still?
Look, it's really, we often talk, it's hard being in small business and having a family. And
especially it's in
challenge.
Our home as well.
It is
so
in our home. The business comes into our
it.
Home all
There's
the time.
There's nowhere to hide.
No,
we try and hide for half a day on a Tuesday and that's often difficult. And it's also... Look, it's a remarkable feat that Sarah and I can live and work together so well. It's not something that you see a lot of, but I would, you know, it's certainly a partnership, you know. It's not one of us or the other, it's both of us. And, you know, I couldn't do it without her and she couldn't do it without me. And Sarah makes bloody good gin now and I can tell lots of bullshit stories and so it works really well. We just move on and
he can attempt to tease me or put me down in front of the staff. But he knows that he'll pay for it later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I will always pay for it, but yeah.
In terms of the challenges, I mean, we've kind of touched on them, but very kind of remote location, small batches, you've got this growing demand. How do you guys handle that? And in your view, what is kind of a bit of a barrier at this point that you need to break through to then go to the next level?
Mm. I mean, at this point in time, we're trying. We've got a few barriers that we're trying to break through. It is a bit of a headache being on the island in terms of a lot of the things that we need to use, we have to ship over, and then we've got to ship everything that's bottled and labelled back. You know, hence today, like, we've got some labels that we're waiting for on the island. If we were anywhere closer, you know, they were ready yesterday, someone could have come and picked them up and got them back. Well, they're not going to get there till Thursday. So it's all those kind of logistics that make it.
20 days last year the boat didn't sail in winter. For whatever reason, whether it's climate change or whether it's the age of the boats. So that becomes the logistical thing. And we often say the best thing about Kangaroo Island is its remoteness, and the worst thing is its remoteness. So that's kind of a barrier. So we'll always be on the island and make our product there, but that's one barrier. Freight, I guess.
We're just about at the point now where, instead of being on the back foot, which we've been for the last 10 years, we're almost on the front foot, so touch
Correct.
Wood. We don't have to be concerned that something's going to take a week instead of, a couple of days.
And where does tension now sit? I mean, this was a sea change. This was about smelling I won't say roses, what's native
the
over there? Gum
the
trees
Illyria.
And,
yes.
and
yes.
seeing some of the platypuses and
beautiful.
Is that the plural? Platypi? Where did that go? Is that, I mean, is this in your nature to always be ambitious?
We plan to go to Kangaroo Island for a holiday one day.
Yeah.
Everybody else that comes to our place is. It's fantastic. We could be doing this in a city, in a different business. You know, we could be running a restaurant or something and would still be putting in those sorts of hours. But we can see some light at the end of the tunnel. And we do work very hard, and we have to remind ourselves that we get to do things like we'll be in Sydney for the next 3 days meeting all sorts of interesting people, and we don't drink social anymore. We only drink professionally, so that's always handy. But it's
just every day.
Every day. look, it's not a bad place to be. And fortunately, even though at times it's very stressful growing a small business, everything that about it has been positive for us. So it's a good problem to have when you can't make enough gin or you're just keeping up all the time. It's frustrating and stressful, but it's not a bad problem to have. And when you get a call from somebody in the mid-coast of New South Wales in a little liquor store saying, we need to get your gin in because our customers are asking for it, and you're thinking, where the hell's that coming from, you know? That all feels good. So it's all positive. It's stressful but positive. It could be stressful in another way and struggling to make a go of it. We look at all the gins that are coming online now and we see similar passions and excitement, and we sort of wonder whether most of them realise that 10 years in we're still not millionaires by any means, and we put an awful lot back in. It's a big step to give up your job and start making something, and you have to, and be in the right place at the right time perhaps. So,
So in terms of what's next? What's kind of your big picture vision for the company? When you think about, okay, geez, where would I want to be in 5 years, 10 years? What's some of the crazy ideas that you guys have maybe been cooking up or distilling, as it were?
Distilling.
There we go. Bang.
We are working towards getting a shed built, which is going to make such a difference to the workspace that we have on the island. And that'll mean having more space as well to entertain people, especially in inclement weather, which we've been getting a fair bit of. So that's our exciting next step that we're working towards. And another possibility is having a warehouse in Adelaide so that shipping can occur from here, because as we said, you know, with the having to wait to get, you know, things off the island and if the boats aren't running, then things don't get to where they're meant to be on time. So if we can eventually establish a warehouse here, we can, send everything out.
Yeah, there's only two real issues on Kangaroo Island that need to be addressed. One is the boat and the other is power.
Not really fundamental.
Strangely enough, I don't know where we're at with any of those things. We've just invested in a generator and we'll go off the grid because it's easier. Well, it's the only way to be reliable. As for the boat, we'll see what happens. But in terms of in the future where we're going, we've decided that we wanted to stay small in Australia. We deal directly with independent bottle shops and high-end on-premise businesses. You'll never find us in Dan's or Coles. If we ramp up to a next stage, it will be to export, but we want to stay this way in Australia so that we can talk to our customer base. You know, we're recently one of four cocktails at Attica, which is probably one of the top restaurants in Melbourne, and we're having a meeting at Bennelong in the Opera House this week. And we're in a lot of good places, and that's who we want to be. If we expand online is one area we're putting some time into, but then also we'll look overseas. We'll see. Maybe some quirky markets. I had an interesting visit from 15 Filipino business people yesterday on a fact-finding sort of tour of small businesses in Australia, and the Philippines is an interesting place, being the biggest consumer of gin in the world, probably most of it not very good, but it'd be an interesting place to look at. So who knows?
My last question, who has been really important in the journey for you besides yourselves?
I'd have to say that Bill certainly has been integral in the early days to get us off the mark.
There isn't groups of mentors, but certainly the food and beverage industry in South Australia has been pretty integral to us. So one of the, like you talked about, we talked before about the culture of drinking and eating good food and local food. Sometimes we refer to our spirits as slow spirits because it's about a bit like slow food movement. So I guess it's that whole movement that has influenced us. South Australia's got a great reputation for all that. Don't know who else.
Well, clearly you've forged your own paths and you haven't had to rely on too many people. So we're going to ask three or four really quick rapid-fire questions. This is always the way that we finish our podcast, and generally speaking, Andrew lets the team down. So this is not scripted, so I'm just going to ask the first question, and sometimes it has nothing to do with gin. The sort of worst sort of fast food or your vice that you have that's food-related that wouldn't really fit with the gin culture.
Ooh. I ran into a great local chef in Kingscote yesterday from American River, and I caught him out the front and he had a box of corn chips and a carton of cigarettes. And that was he's a fantastic chef, and that was he saying, yeah, chef's diet. And I'm going, yeah, I get it. What's our passion? Our passion is too much of it.
Hot donuts.
Hot donuts.
Sarah's is hot donuts. What would mine be? Potato cakes.
Potato cakes. There you go. The old fish and chip shop.
Yeah.
What about the drink other than your own that you just absolutely loved? Like it actually blew your mind. When you had a drink, is there something that comes to mind for both of you? And any type of drink.
One of my favourites was an aged grappa that we picked up in Rome. A bottle thereof. Sarah had to leave the room when I purchased it because she didn't want to know how much I paid for it. But it was a grappa is mostly people think about window cleaner because as a peasant drink, it was about claiming back spirit from Mark and it was pretty rough as guts. But in recent decades, the grappa industry has become more focused with premium varietal grappas. This particular one was Muscat grape. And aged for 8 years in wood. And to me, it was beyond a cognac or Armagnac. It was the most glorious drink I've ever drunk.
Not sure?
Sake.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's my... I'm a sake fan.
The biggest, boldest personality on the island.
God, there's a few of them.
Yeah, well, I often... You know, lived in the western suburbs of Adelaide. I grew up in Sydney and it was an interesting change to go to Kangaroo Island, and the way that I deal with it is think about the TV show Sea Change and the characters. I won't use the word buffoon, but, there's some very glossy characters, some aspiring politicians, crumbs.
Pick one.
On the island? Yep. John Ayliffe, the guy that feeds the pelicans in Kingscote. He's a larger-than-life character. He's a very...
Every day or?
Every day he goes down there and feeds the pelicans at 5:30 on the rocks in King's Cove.
Last one from me. The most famous person who has ever drunk one of your spirits?
There's been a few. Attenborough.
David Attenborough, yeah.
He did a launch. They did a launch in London with our gin for a campaign about Australian tourism and coastal issues, and so he was involved in that.
Did he describe it in his voice? And the old Tom.
We didn't get to go. We didn't get to go. Our bottles have travelled better than we have. Locally, who do we like?
Soul at,
there was chef with glasses from London.
Blumenfeld.
Yeah, Blumenfeld. Yep, he came and drank our gin there.
Had Molly Ringwald come into the cellar door.
I didn't know who she was, asked her what she did.
Had she aged a little bit from?
No, she
had no idea who she was. Sarah was beside herself.
What was the movie? What was she in?
Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club, that's right.
Yes.
My last question, and I'm going to steal Monty's thunder here because he usually asks this one, but an important album in your history, in your journey, music album, music album.
There'd have to be two on this side of the table. I'm sure we have quite different tastes. Sarah's convinced I can't dance because I'm 10 years older than her, but album.
Paul Kelly.
Or musician.
Paul Kelly.
Paul, yeah. Kelly or Midnight Oil.
Great Australian sounds.
Midnight Oil.
Well, look, John and Sarah, thank you for being so generous with your time. It's been amazing to sit and hear your journey of what is a small to medium business now, and it's growing and gaining a lot of traction, and a lot of people are talking about it around the place. So really appreciate squeezing Rooster Radio into your hectic schedule.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Rooster Radio. Find out more about Kangaroo Island Spirits at kispirits.com.au. If you're enjoying Rooster Radio, remember to subscribe and review on iTunes. Sign up to our mailing list and listen to more episodes at roosterradio.biz. And finally, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/roosterradiohq.